fascist wanted to leave us out of the world today. Tell them that we the people don't want another Vietnam in Afghanistan.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. you're just joining us, we're listening to The End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Bacevich.
So the bottom line is that wildly exaggerated expectations about American military prowess and staying power have opened up a huge gap between Washington's professed goals and the capabilities at hand to pursue those goals. I think there are two ways to close that gap, and here I'll conclude. The first is to abandon any expectation that technology will transform war, and therefore to get serious about raising up forces that an open-ended global war will require, not simply today, but 5 years from now and 10 years from now. Because if we're going to undertake a war to change the way they live, that's going to be a protracted struggle. But the second way to close the gap is to revise our goals and to see open-ended war as inherently flawed and unsustainable and unwise, and in its place to chart a course consistent with our values and with the means available. And in a sense, that may mean turning Rumsfeld's diktat on its head. Perhaps to preserve the American way of life, we should change it while giving up on fantasies of changing the way other people live. Speaking for myself, I prefer the latter choice. And with that, I'll stop and look forward to any comments or questions that you may have. Thank you very much. So I guess people with questions should step up to the microphones. And again, we'd like to let the students to have the first crack. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. The previous speaker in this lecture series offered targeted strikes by drones, special forces, and the CIA as an alternative to major military operations. How has having these options affected decision-making, in your opinion, about the use of the military? And does that also contribute to taking us away from worrying about winning hearts and minds or make policymakers more cavalier about taking military action?
That's a good question. President Obama, I don't think President Obama was qualified to be commander-in-chief when he became commander-in-chief. That's actually not a hit on President Obama, who was qualified to be commander-in-chief when elected to this office. But remember, this is a guy who, how long had he been in the Senate? 2 years or four? First term, anyway. One term, just a very brief time on the national stage. And suddenly we thrust him into this office. And I don't think that actually he had thought through He was going to learn on the job how to be commander-in-chief. And he's reached some important conclusions. One of those is that invading and occupying countries is a dumb idea. I mean, he basically understood that when he ran, because he ran as the president who would get us out of Iraq. But unfortunately, he also ran as the president who was going to escalate Afghanistan. And you recall that when he did escalate Afghanistan in 2009, it was at a time when the infatuation with counterinsurgency doctrine, that's the winning hearts and minds, nation building, he escalated the Afghanistan war at a time when the infatuation with counterinsurgency doctrine was at its height. But I think he learned rather quickly that counterinsurgency doctrine wasn't going to work in Afghanistan any more than it worked in Iraq. And he pivoted fairly quickly and started drawing deadlines when we would get out of Afghanistan. Well, what then would be his approach to waging the war on terror? Because he certainly hasn't abandoned that notion. And the solution he came up with is this emphasis on missile-firing drones and special operations forces. And there are some advantages that come with that. He doesn't get us bogged down with tens of thousands of U.S. troops going back for multiple combat tours. Drones and special operations forces reduce the costs, human cost and economic cost, to us. They are less controversial, at least in terms of our domestic politics, not necessarily less controversial if you talk to Pakistanis about it. So I can understand why he opted for that, but it seems to me that what he has done has embraced a tactical approach to waging war while fundamentally avoiding any larger strategic or political questions.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I mean, if you said to the president, well, how many drone strikes will we have to execute before knowing that we're done? We're killing bad guys onesies and twosies at a time. How many of them are there? And when will we know that the mission is complete and that Obama's version of the global war on terrorism will end? And it's a question that can't be answered, especially because there's considerable evidence that even as we kill onesies and twosies, we're also killing some number of non-combatants and inflaming opinion among a much larger number of people. So my problem with Obama's way of war is that it too fails to confront the Clausewitz's dictum. War is the continuation of politics. War is about politics. War makes no sense unless the conduct of war plausibly leads to some apparently very important political purpose. Only in that circumstance, it seems to me, can there be any justification for engaging in violence? And I just don't see a political outcome. Yes?
Assuming that America completely discards its sense of exceptionalism, what changes do you think will follow or should follow in terms of military force in diplomacy?
If we discard our sense of exceptionalism, what differences would that lead to our military posture and policy? Well, how would you define American exceptionalism?
The stance that we should take part in Sudan, Afghanistan.
Okay, I would give a different definition. My definition would be that American exceptionalism is the conviction that we are called upon, I use passive voice, that God or providence or history, some higher force, has called upon us to transform the world and indeed to remake the world in our own image. American exceptionalism is rooted in the conception that what we have is what they want and need, and that our purpose is to give it to them. And especially in the post-Cold War era, as I tried to suggest in the talk, people in Washington, and frankly people not necessarily in Washington, have come to believe that the military instrument is the means, the best available means, whereby we should accomplish that larger purpose. And the military means has fallen short. I would think that were we to forfeit our belief in American exceptionalism, I cannot imagine how that would occur, but were we to forfeit it, that could well lead to greater realism, pragmatism, and modesty in thinking about when it will be appropriate to use force. Because we would have shed this foolish notion that God has deputized us to be his agent. Yes, sir?
As a group of young voters, many haven't even voted in a presidential election of my generation. What do you think we should be looking for in the upcoming elections, next time the presidential election rolls around, to rejuvenate the economy but still maintain a strong military presence?
This is where my pessimism kicks in. I'm not going to give an adequate answer to your very good question. I would simply note that when our current president ran back in 2008, he energized Americans, particularly young Americans, in ways that hadn't been seen in quite some time. It was remarkable. In some respects, it was quite moving. I mean, I bet you 95% of us watched the gathering in Grant Park on the night of the election. And it was incredible because this was our first African-American president, and all the meant in a historical context. But it was special because of what he seemed to represent. Youth, vigor, clear intelligence. I believe strongly to the present moment that the president is a very decent man, a good man. What I didn't share was the exalted expectations that a messianic figure had now been delivered to the Oval Office and that all was going to be well. And he turned out not to be a messianic figure, and all's not well. So the only thing I would say in response to your guy, I have no idea who ought to run, who we should elect. I would simply say, temper your expectations, because our system is such that there is no one person that we could deliver to the Oval Office that would somehow make things right. And quite frankly, we probably should be grateful for all the flaws of our system. We should be grateful that there is no one person who could be delivered to make things right, because that would also open the possibility of somebody getting into the Oval Office who would really do terrible, evil, awful things. So that's my political philosophy. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. So later in November, there are a bunch of students from this college going to Fort Benning to protest the School of Americas. And I was just wondering what your view on this organization is and if it kind of represents another aspect of...
Well, it's no longer called School of the Americas, right?
No, it has changed. I don't remember what it's called.
I mean, I haven't followed this, but to tell you the truth, I think the fact that neither one of us can remember what the school is called. I'm not poking at you here. It is possible that whatever that entity is, that it's no longer the School of the Americas, not only in name but also in substance. I would say that there was a time when there was an entity called the School of the Americas, and there's pretty substantial evidence that at a minimum, it was a source of training for Latin American officers who ended up committing all kinds of human rights abuses. And there's some amount of evidence that that was the purpose of the School of the Americas. In other words, it wasn't just an inadvertent effect, but it was an intentional effect. I have a general sense that the Army, without ever actually confessing its sins, has tacitly acknowledged that they screwed up, and that one of the reasons the school moved from Panama to Benning and that it changed its name is that they're trying to put that behind them. So I would simply say, you want to make sure that when you're go protest, but you want to make sure that you're protesting the current circumstances, not protesting against what happened in El Salvador 20 years ago. You know, the making a broad judgment, Latin American militaries, regardless of how dirty American hands are, Latin American militaries back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, had a pretty lousy reputation in terms of the professionalism of the officer corps. I think that there's been some pretty considerable improvement. Not that we should claim the credit for it, but as there's been a transformation of Latin American politics more broadly, and to some degree I think that has led to improvements in the professionalism of Latin American militaries. So we just want to make sure that we're throwing the stones at the right people.
Yes, thank you.
Good evening, Professor. First off, I just wanted to thank you for coming to talk with us tonight. It's definitely special.
It's my honor.
My question for you is, when we look at history and look at the Vietnam War, I remember I don't remember personally, but America went into the war to fight communism spreading across Asia and basically everywhere across the world. What makes you think that our attacks on Islamic modernity in Iraq were much different than communist uprisings in Vietnam? To me, it seems as if it's just a reverse approach, but a similar technique. And my question for you is, how did we view it as appropriate when we decided we have to stop the spread of communism, but we must spread democratic capitalism?
Well, you've asked a very complicated question, I think. No. I mean, maybe I can separate it into two questions. And the one question would be, why did the Vietnam War happen? And I don't think there's an easy answer there. But I would cite the following reasons. A, what came to be a exaggerated fear of communism, inaccurately portrayed, and what I mean there is that the notion that communism was a monolith, therefore leading people, some of them honestly making this mistake, people to say, oh, a communist in Vietnam is the same as a communist in China, is the same as a communist in the Soviet Union, is the same as a communist in Minnesota, right? To merge disparate entities together into one behemoth. You cannot, however, discount the importance of domestic politics in explaining the Vietnam War. Democrats perceived that the loss of China had deeply discredited the Truman administration. And Democrats like John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson both lived in fear of being tagged with being similarly weak. And therefore, for domestic political reasons, they needed to look tough in a place like Vietnam. You cannot overlook the posturing of the Soviet Union. Remember, the Soviets are perceived to be calling the shots in places like Vietnam. They weren't. And therefore, the bluster of somebody like Nikita Khrushchev, who in 1961 gives a famous speech in which he says that the Soviet Union is going to be supporting wars of national liberation everywhere, leading somebody like Kennedy to say, oh, I guess we need to oppose that. You cannot overlook the understandable, even if misguided, efforts on the part of military thinkers to try to find an escape from what they viewed as the nuclear danger, which led them to experiment with and invent alternative ways of using force. The simplest term to apply to this would be flexible response. You have to develop new capabilities. I think you have to also weigh the factor here or throw in the notion that once they, Kennedy and then Johnson, both increased our commitment, they didn't have the guts to admit failure and their mistakes. So it was easier. It became easier to send another 100,000 U.S. troops to Vietnam than to say, Jesus, we shouldn't have sent the last 100,000. Now, I myself don't see the Iraq War as comparable. I don't mean somehow better. It just seems to me that the circumstances are quite different. And in a sense, worse. As I tried to suggest in the talk, I know there are many different views about why we went to war in Iraq. And if we did a poll, some people would say, oil. Some people would say, Israel. Some people would say, it was George W. Bush's complicated relationship with his father, and he wanted to do what his father couldn't do. And by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, we'd, And I wouldn't discount any of those.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Barack Obama, and I'm running for president. But tonight I'm here to talk about the somewhat unusual nature of my name. I know that there are some people out there who think that a politician should have a more traditional American-sounding name, like Mark Foley or Larry Craig. Or even my cousin Dick Cheney. I'd also like to address the fact that my last name is similar to the first name of a man who has declared himself to be an enemy of the United States. And to that end, I thought it'd be a good idea if you saw us both in the same place at the same time, so you could see how very different we are.
My beard is black, my robe is white, my videotapes can give a fright.
And I'm half black, and I'm half white. Obama is Irish, not Islamite.
He's freakishly bright. I've got the bounty on my head.
It looks like bounty towels instead on your head.
The world is black. I'm filled with rage. You'll find it on my new MySpace page. I live in caves.
In the US, we give cavemen sitcoms on TV. Hey, don't you see? If you had a sitcom like those Geico cavemen, you could hide out someplace where no one would ever see you.
On NBC.
And now for something completely different.